everyone. You may have noticed it's been a couple weeks since we published our podcast. As many of our listeners may know, University of Idaho suffered a tragedy a number of weeks ago. Four of our students were killed in a homicide off of campus, and Kyle and I had to step away from the podcast to make sure that we were able to do everything we could to support our students and employees and greater Vandal family. We are back on it now, so the rest of the season will be coming out over the next month or so. Hope you enjoy them. Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Vandal Theory, a podcast about science and research at the University of Idaho. I'm Lee Cooper, your host, and I am the science writer and editor here at U of I. I'm also joined by my co-host for today, Kyle.
Hi, everyone. I'm Kyle Fonensteel, media relations manager at U of I.
Hey, how's it going, Kyle?
Good. How about you?
Not too shabby. We got our first snow of the year.
Fun, fun, fun.
I know. Always love scraping off the car the first time. All right. So today we're going to talk about how researchers are using genetics to conserve wildlife. And Kyle, I've got my question for you all prepared.
Okay.
What kind of tools come to mind when you think about wildlife conservation?
I guess I'm thinking of pretty physical tools that you use to track how wildlife move around in the forest. I'm thinking of cameras in the wilderness tracking wildlife's behavioral patterns and movement patterns, and also of satellite-enabled collars or tags on them to track their movement, things that wildlife researchers will use to track physical movement.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Those are kind of the standard practice, at least those are the ones that I always saw, you know, watching National Geographic shows about protecting various types of animals. Whales and wolves and things like that. We're going to learn about a whole new toolkit used for wildlife management from Lisette Waits, who is a distinguished professor in the Department of Fish and Wildlife Sciences. She's going to tell us quite a few stories about how she's used genetics to help wildlife conservation and how the science has changed over time. All right, you ready to go, Kyle?
I'm very ready.
Aces, let's start. Hi, Lisette. Welcome to The Vandal Theory. I'm so excited that you're able to join us today.
Hi, Lee. It is great to be here.
Can you officially introduce yourself to everyone?
Yes. So I am Lisette Waits, and I've been a faculty member here at the University of Idaho in the Fish and Wildlife Sciences Department for 25 years. And I do research in the area of wildlife conservation, genetics, and molecular ecology.
All right. I think we're probably going to have to break that down. What does that actually mean? So can we just start with how generally you mash together genetics and wildlife conservation?
Yes. So a lot of people are familiar with how genetics has really changed our crime-fighting field. You maybe watched CSI on television, and you're kind of always reading about how genetics has changed the medical field and all of the things that we can do. And there have been similar changes in what we can do with genetics in wildlife conservation. There's actually a new field called genetic monitoring that we use to answer questions and provide information about wildlife using genetics. We can get DNA from animals that we capture. We can take their blood or take a tissue sample from them. But one of the major advancements is we can also get DNA from things that animals just leave behind in the environment. So hair samples, fecal samples, which we call scat usually, and saliva, feathers from birds. We can take just a water sample and get DNA out of everything that lives in that water. Even things like footprints on snow, we can get the DNA from the animal that was walking on the snow.
Oh, that's amazing.
So what do we do with that DNA, you know, once we get it? So there are lots of different questions we can answer. So we can find and count endangered species just from picking up their poop out there or finding a hair sample that we left behind. So, you know, people are aware that wolves were reintroduced in Idaho, and our lab helped figure out, you know, how quickly they expanded by the fact that biologists had some of them radio collared, but not all of them were radio collared. And we were able to find fecal samples and hair samples out across Idaho and figure out, is this a wolf or is it a coyote or is it a dog, just from the DNA. Also, we can use it to detect invasive species that are going to be a problem for the environment. Our lab worked on methods to take New Zealand mud snail DNA and detect it in a water sample. And they did that with Asian carp in the Great Lakes, which were a big risk to the fisheries in the Great Lakes region. Other things that we can do is detect things that are threats to endangered species. And for the red wolf species, which is found in North Carolina, that I work on, it was reintroduced in North Carolina, and one of its threats was hybridizing with coyotes. So it would breed with coyotes and produce pups that were a mixture of red wolf and coyote. And genetics would be the only way to know that had happened. So our laboratory would receive samples from pups from dens or fecal samples found out in the landscape and extract the DNA and say, is this a red wolf? Is it a coyote? Is it a hybrid? Also, we can use DNA to answer a question of whether things are new species. Like, is it a species that we've never detected before? It's so genetically different, we should call it a new species. And we're looking at that for bats in the Galapagos Islands. The Galapagos have a lot of unique species that aren't found anywhere else. And we can also use that to ask, like, how long ago did they get to the Galapagos Islands? And where do they come from? How many different colonization events happened? All that information is recorded in their DNA. So it is a super powerful tool.
So it seems like, I mean, one, you just listed like at least half a dozen types of questions that you can ask with this. I've done things like the radio collars on wolves, and it's a lot of work. So is that one of the reasons, like, let's talk 30,000 foot view. What makes this such a powerful tool compared to some of the other tools that you would be using?
Yeah, so that's definitely one of the things that makes this a powerful tool is that it is cheap and efficient compared to trapping and collaring. When they were deciding to try to capture coyotes, for example, in the Red Wolf recovery area, and with fecal samples or hair samples, they might have known it was in the area, it could take a week to capture a particular animal that they knew was there. And that was a lot of people time. And then once you radio collar an animal, you're going to fly around, usually in an airplane or a helicopter, to track it. That is super expensive. We can do hundreds to thousands of genetic samples for the cost to like do trapping and radio collaring of one wolf, for example. So it's a really cost-effective way to get this information. And sometimes we can answer questions that just are impossible to answer any other way. Maybe we can't catch the animals. Maybe they're really difficult to capture. Or maybe they have a high chance of dying when you capture them, which happens with Sonoran pronghorn that live in the desert, for example. And so ethically, we just don't want to capture them and radio collar them, and we need another way to study them. You know, you can pick up wildlife in cameras, and people are using cameras as a non-invasive way to track them. And they picked up an animal in California that looked like a wolf. But without the DNA or without a capture, you don't know for sure. Genetics becomes a really powerful tool because they might try to capture this one wolf that they think they saw for weeks and weeks and be unsuccessful. But there's often a lot of poop out there, and they can start picking that up, sending it to us, and we can tell them, yes, it's a wolf. We can tell them where it came from. In fact, we did. We said, this came from a pack in Oregon. In fact, we knew the wolf because it had been captured and collared in Oregon. It was no longer collared when it went to California, but the DNA is like a unique identifier. It's a fingerprint that we can detect it again. And another really valuable thing that makes it powerful is the public can get involved with helping collect samples. And this happened, for example, in Sweden. they decided they wanted to get an estimate of the number of brown bears in Sweden. And one of the ways that they did it was they asked the hunters in Sweden who were out hunting for moose to collect fecal samples for bears. And then they gave that to the scientist who did DNA fingerprinting to say how many bears are present in Scandinavia. I've also done this with Andean bears in Ecuador, where we could work with local people and indigenous communities that lived in the high Andes to collect hair and fecal samples from Andean bears. And then finally, it's powerful because this information can go directly into adaptive management and management plans for wildlife. Like in California, we documented, yes, wolves have made it to California. So that completely changed, you know, how they needed to be doing wildlife management in that area.
Absolutely. How did you get into this? How much has it changed since you got into it?
So I've always been interested in science. I knew I wanted to be a scientist. And early on, I thought I was going to be a marine biologist. And then I got really excited about genetics. And when I started my PhD, I was working in the field of human genetics. But I had the opportunity to work on brown bears in Yellowstone and to start doing genetic work, looking at how they were related to brown bears all over North America. And that got me interested in doing wildlife genetics again and coming back and bringing this really interesting genetic technique into wildlife ecology and conservation. And it's changed so much since I started. When I was first doing this work, we could only get DNA from a blood sample or a tissue sample. When I first started, they weren't powerful enough to get DNA from a water sample or a fecal sample. And when we looked at the DNA, we would sequence and kind of read the DNA of maybe 300, 400 base pairs of DNA.
Just a snippet of a full animal's DNA.
In fact, animals have 2 to 3 billion base pairs of DNA. And we were looking at 300 to 400. But now we can do the whole genome. Now, we don't do the whole genome on every wildlife project, but we have the ability to do that. And we can also look at specific parts of it. We can look at the sex chromosomes so that I can tell you if an animal is a male or a female. We can kind of target in on those. We can look at places in the DNA that we know are important for fighting disease. And we want to do that for species like bighorn sheep that are having die-offs from pneumonia and disease. We want to understand how does the DNA protect some populations and not protect others. We can also do much more for less money. That is another like huge change, is that, you know, it's become much less expensive to sequence the whole genome. I can sequence the whole genome of a species for about $1,000 now.
Which is amazing, because I mean, I remember when it was a international multi-institute project to sequence the human genome, let alone whatever animal we fancied.
Exactly. The technology has changed so much that we can do a lot more for a lot less money. And it's now become such a commonly used technique. It's part of the training for wildlife students and fisheries students to be learning about these genetic methods. And many of them do research in my laboratory as undergrads.
So just out of curiosity, I know you said that I don't know how many animals you've worked with over your entire lifetime, 50, 100?
At least 50, yeah.
At least 50, okay. Do you have any, we've done a lot of examples, but do you have a couple of gems that kind of stand out?
Yeah. So one of the examples that, it's work that I haven't done, but I just think it's so cool, is that one of the ways that people are tracking endangered species in the tropics now is taking leeches or blood-sucking flies and collecting them, smashing them up, extracting their DNA, and basically finding the DNA of what they sucked on from that blood.
That's a little Jurassic Park-esque for me.
Yeah, it's a whole new way to do biodiversity surveys, and they found endangered species that they didn't know lived in a certain part of Asia, for example, from using this really creative method to do a biodiversity survey. In terms of things that I've worked on, I think to me one of the most amusing ones was in Yellowstone Park. They had a problem with a bear that was smashing tents. It just found tents to be fascinating, and it liked to jump on them, which is a problem, you know, if anybody was in it. It was a problem even if they weren't in it, because they were usually poles broken, etc. So the managers obviously needed to capture this bear. But from the scene of the crime, they had taken some hair samples and sent them to me. And then they set up a decoy tent and a way to capture a bear that was smashing tents. So they captured the bear with this decoy, and then they sent me a hair sample from the bear they captured to say, did we get the right bear? Did we get this famous tent smashing bear? And I was able to say, yes, you did. This is the same individual bear. And that got sent off to a zoo. And so that was just a really fun crime scene type project that we got to do.
Law and Order, Wildlife
exactly.
Edition.
CSI, Wildlife.
Well, any other examples?
Yeah, another really interesting example is that we are using these kinds of methods to look at survival in reintroduced pygmy rabbits in Washington. So we take a genetic sample of a captive animal before it's released into the wild. And then in the winter, we go with University of Idaho students to look for burrows and tracks and then fecal samples of these rabbits. And we take the DNA from those fecal samples and we do a fingerprint of the DNA and we match it back to all those rabbits that we released into the wild. So we find out which ones survived. But we can also find out which ones reproduced. We can, if we find a rabbit that we didn't release, then we knew it was born in the wild. And we can use DNA to find the parents of that rabbit and find out which ones are reproducing. Another thing that we do with genetic analysis is just evaluate how much genetic variation is present in a population. And does it have gene flow to other populations, or are there barriers on the landscape keeping animals from moving? And we care about this because genetic variation is important for survival and fitness. And I've done this with grizzly bears in Yellowstone, for example. I did some of the early work that showed that grizzly bears in Yellowstone are isolated and they are not exchanging genes with other populations, and that they're losing genetic variation over time, because there's just a limited number of breeders in the Yellowstone ecosystem. And so this is a threat to their long-term recovery. And using genetics to gather this information is really important for managers. Another really cool thing that we can do with genetics is take that fecal sample and we can tell you what species it came from. We can tell you what individual it came from, but we can also tell you everything it ate. So if it's an herbivore, like these endangered northern Idaho ground squirrels that are found only in Idaho, we can tell you what plants that species has been eating. And that tells the managers when they're doing restoration what plants are important to plant in the area. We've even connected the plants that it's eating with their chance of survival. And we've been able to do DNA analysis and say when they eat these plants, they're more likely to survive. And so these plants are particularly important.
So obviously there seems to be quite a few pluses for using genetics in wildlife conservation and you know, just tracking these populations. Of course, whenever a new toy comes on the market, everybody wants to dive in and try their hand at it. Are there pitfalls that scientists have found, like, I need to really kind of understand the nuances of this before using it officially?
First of all, it really requires specialized training to get it right. And that getting it right starts in the field when you collect samples to send to a wildlife genetics laboratory. You need to avoid contamination in the field in terms of, you know, getting your DNA on the sample or mixing DNA between samples. One of the big pitfalls is, you know, contamination. And, you know, when you watch crime shows, you see they put on the gloves and they're really careful. That same kind of care is needed in wildlife genetics. And then once the sample gets to the lab, we need really specialized training to avoid contamination problems and mixing up samples within a lab. Other pitfalls are, you know, if we're wanting to work with things like footprints and saliva and things that animals have left behind, fecal samples in the environment, there's really small amount of DNA there. And so when you first start trying to do this, it often just doesn't work very well. Maybe it only works 10% of the time. Maybe it only works 20% of the time. So it takes a lot of optimization and kind of working out your methods, and they can be different with each species.
Really?
Yes. You think you could work it out once with a particular system and, you know, you're getting 90% success and you feel like you've mastered it. And then you go to a new species and you're back down to 30% again. We are finding, for example, that otters are difficult to get DNA from their fecal samples, while deer, we can get 90% success rate on getting DNA from their fecal samples. So low success rates are a big challenge, and kind of just figuring out the puzzle on why they work better for some species than others and how to improve so they work well for all species is another part of the challenge.
Any idea why the discrepancy, why otters are problems?
Well, one of the reasons we think otters are problems has to do with their having a large amount of fish in their diet. And we think something about the fish diet interferes with our ability to get the DNA of the otter out of their fecal samples. And one of the reasons why we believe this is true is I took bears at Washington State University and fed them a lot of different diet items. We fed them plants, we fed them deer, we fed them carrots, berries, and we also fed them salmon. And their success rates were about 60-70% when we were feeding them most diet items, and they dropped to 20% when they were eating salmon. So that gave us evidence that there's something about a fish diet. If you look at the fecal samples, they definitely get weirder and mushier and slimier. There's definitely something different about them, and whatever that is makes it harder for us to get the DNA out.
So going back to the original question I asked, did we get through all the kind of pitfalls, or was there another one you wanted to mention?
Yeah, another pitfall I would say is that you need specialized training to get the laboratory work right, but you also need specialized training to interpret how many different individuals do you have in a sample, to evaluate how genetic diversity or gene flow might be changing over time, or to evaluate whether hybridization occurred or not. You can have different scientists actually coming to different conclusions depending on how they ran the analyses. And so that is another challenge or pitfall.
So we're kind of getting towards the end here. What do you want our listeners to remember about genetics in wildlife conservation?
So first, I want them to remember that DNA and the genetic diversity within DNA is important because it's the raw material that all life and all of this cool physical diversity that we see around us is based on. And this genetic variation in the DNA is critical to survival of species, to survival of specific populations. And genetic methods are giving us a powerful new way to monitor that genetic diversity, to monitor wildlife, to understand wildlife, to manage and protect wildlife.
All right. Well, Lisette, thank you so much for coming on today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a lot of fun to talk about this subject that I love so much.
All right. Kyle, what did you think of that one?
That was really fascinating. I was especially interested in what Lisette was saying about all these different applications for genomics and ways you can use it as this broad tool to understand the world. As she was talking about all of that, I was thinking about how we all got kind of an elementary understanding of genetics as the COVID pandemic started up, and scientists were constantly talking about new variants and genetic mutations, variations that the virus can take on over time as it transmits from person to person, and people became very used to using a lot of this foreign vocabulary in their everyday lives to talk about this. And I can't help but think about the parallels between some of the tools it gave us to understand the world, such as how the virus will spread in different environments under different variants, and how you can adopt different precautions under different variants, and also some of the innovative applications that she talked about, such as, you know, taking water samples to discover what kind of species live in an area, and tracking the growth of endangered species by knowing who you've released and who they're breeding with. It's very fascinating to see how much of a multi-purpose tool genomics can be to understanding the world.
Yeah, I kept waiting for her to run out of new examples or new ways to use genetics, and she never did. It's fascinating to me, like, use the term multi-tool, and I think that that's a really applicable metaphor for this. I mean, this is not a tool that is used in one precise area for one precise thing. It is something that so many sciences are picking up and using across the board to answer all these complicated questions that, as she said, quite possibly could be impossible to answer any other way. So, yeah, just the overwhelming ways that this tool can be used just boggled my mind.
Yes, and it makes me very excited to hear what scientists figure out how to use this tool in effective ways. So I'm very excited.
Absolutely. It's so fascinating and exciting to follow along with scientists on this journey. All right, everyone. Thank you for listening to The Vandal Theory. You can visit our website, uidaho.edu/vandaltheory, if you want to learn more about this type of research. You can also email us at vandaltheory@uidaho.edu if you have questions or comments or anything like that. We're also on basically all the podcasting platforms out there, and we'd love it if you'd go and subscribe, maybe rate and review us while you're there. All right, I'm Lee Cooper.
And I'm Kyle Fawnensteel.
And thanks for listening today.